I'm talking today about social media because I really believe that social media is going to play an increasingly important role in the future of both education and business. And one of the things I would like our talk to be today is interactive, because after all, that's what social media is. So I encourage you, if during my talk something occurs to you that you'd like to ask or add to the conversation, please just raise your hand and chime in. No need to hold things for the end. To that end, too, I brought a couple copies of one of the books that we use in our company to help our leaders figure out how to get their message across to people. So I'll give me a couple of those away today, too, to anyone who's brave enough to answer a couple questions for me. Well, Jim already gave me a better introduction than I can give myself. But here is the contact info for both me and my company. I encourage you to connect with me either via Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, any of the kind of mainstream social media tools. I love talking with other bright, creative people. I think it was Bill Gates who said some time back that the secret to his success was surrounding himself with people who were smarter than he was. And that's absolutely true. Any success I have, I absolutely owe to the people who have come to join me over the years. Okay, so what we're going to cover today is going to run from, we're going to start with the reach and impact of social media, and we're going to end up at a topic that I know is near and dear to businesses and educational institutions alike, which is, what's my return on investment? So if I'm going to go play around on Facebook or Twitter or allow my employees or my students to do that, how do I know they're not going to play around? How do I actually quantify that? There's actually been a lot of research done in this. This is something we help companies answer for themselves, and I think you'll find some of the data there to be pretty provocative. Those are two words I never thought I'd use in a sentence, but I actually think it's pretty true. What I'd like to do to start out with looking at the reach and impact of social media is actually show you a brief piece of media. It's a 4-minute video put together by a gentleman by the name of Eric Qualman. Some of you may have seen this or been familiar with him. He is the vice president of a global search consulting company based in Geneva, Switzerland, although he himself works out of Boston. And in 2009, he wrote a book called Socialnomics, looking at the economic impact of social media. All of the information in this video is current as of September 2009, so it's very recent and relevant. So I encourage you to pick up this book if you get a chance. It's pretty fascinating. The two things I hope that you take away from that video are that the game has already changed. In just the last couple of years, we've seen a really fundamental shift in the way that people communicate. I want you also to take away that social media is broader than just the platforms that are mentioned. It is a new way of thought that everyone should be allowed to, and in fact can, participate in the conversation, whether you want to or not. I've talked with people about concerns around how companies set privacy policies and things around social media. While that's important, realize that the vast majority of your employees, especially the younger ones, are going to be on Facebook and on Twitter, and they're going to be talking about their job satisfaction, and they're going to be comparing notes, because that's what they do. I want to give away one of my books. Does anybody know the ratio of total number of people in Gen Y to Gen X? Or would like to hazard a guess?
2-1.
That's right, 2-1.
That was just a guess.
It happens to be the same ratio, or roughly the same ratio, as baby boomers to Gen X. And this has some pretty interesting implications. As you saw in that video, it said by 2010, which is, you know, now, Gen Y is the largest cohort in the workforce. Well, if we assume that there's a relatively equal distribution of talent and intelligence and education across the generations, and a relatively equal distribution of roles from executives to pizza delivery drivers across every generation, what does that mean as baby boomers start to retire? It means that, let's say in a given year you have 10,000 people who are managers and executives who are baby boomers. If there's only half as many Gen Xers to replace them, where do you get those other 5,000 executives and managers? you get them from the folks in Gen Y who are ambitious, who are getting their MBAs, and who are on top of the game and help companies take it to the next level. So what it means from an educational perspective is that the people who continue their education and continue to embrace and extend these technologies are going to have an enormous advantage earlier in their career than people in Gen X have. What it also means is that there's twice as many people in Gen Y who are going to be competing for the same jobs. So the penalty for not keeping up is just as much as the downside or the upside of keeping up. From a business perspective, your brand, your perception, your customers, and your employees own this now. We just have to get used to that. Bad news travels fast. If you screw up, people are going to hear about it. But so do stories of good news. Some examples from this, if you consider what's happened in the world in the last couple of years, if you look at the Obama campaign in 2008, they raised unprecedented amounts of money and organized unprecedented amounts of volunteers via social media. If you look at what happened with the disputed election in Iran this past fall, what normally would have been a closed event that we didn't really know much about suddenly was talked about on Twitter and became top of mind for a lot of people. It has not changed that regime yet, but consider what this could mean, not just for Iran, but for larger countries like China, where there's going to be social upheaval in coming years as people are more exposed to the freedoms that are out there in the world. And then just this past 2 weeks ago, after the devastating earthquake in Haiti, within 18 hours of the first reports of the earthquake, there was an application in the Apple store to allow you to donate money to Haiti. Within 36 hours, AT&T and a couple of other foundations made it possible to donate via text message on your phone, and over $100 million was raised to help people through social media. From a business perspective, as it said in the video, the key takeaway is that the temptation of social media is that you've basically been given a free microphone. And the temptation for businesses is to broadcast their traditional marketing methods to try to sell and spin. Well, when you have millions or even billions of people, what it means is that the amplitude has been ramped up on everybody's BS detectors. So you don't get to do that anymore. Not if you're smart. If you listen and help, the potential benefit to you is huge. If you consider as a customer, we've all had bad customer service experiences. It's just kind of become the norm in America, unfortunately. But there's two kinds of stories you tell your friends. You tell your friends the stories of people who really screwed things up. But more importantly, you tell the stories of people who screwed things up and then went out of their way to make it right. And those are the companies that get higher recommendations from people in general than the ones who just do what they're supposed to do. So these new social medias have great implications for companies if they use them correctly. Let's look real briefly at some of the tools. I'm not going to go into these in great detail because I think people are already fairly familiar with these three. The key thing that I would tell you as any of you who are current MBA students is that things like Facebook and LinkedIn allow you to be more than socialize or post an online resume. What they really do, what Twitter really does, is it allows you to demonstrate your expertise. The value in these, you know, being able to answer questions on LinkedIn, for example, or to post relevant links on Twitter, these things can all build credibility. So there needs to be some thought into how you use these. One thing I would add about this slide, and actually one thing I would ask of you, and I'll give away my second book for this one, is if I had made this slide 18 months ago, what would be on here that's not on here now? MySpace. Yes. I'm not sure which one you answered this, so you may have to fight over there. MySpace was the number one social network in America 18 months ago, before Facebook opened up the doors to everybody. And then, you know, MySpace isn't gone. But the key thing to take away from this is, as a business, you have to be able to adapt very quickly. And you saw in the video the amount of time it took for different technologies to be established. If Facebook gets to 100 million users in 9 months, what that practically means for business is you have 1/98th the amount of time to figure out what you're going to do with Facebook that you did when radio came out. You know, you have 1/20th the amount of time to figure out what you're going to do with Facebook that you did when TV came out. that presents both a problem and a pretty intriguing opportunity, because if something comes on the scene that quickly, businesses who are smart about it, individuals who are smart about it, can get market share and mind share in a way that's very hard to do. If you're a startup now and you want to get mind share via TV, you better have millions and millions of dollars to advertise. But if you can do it for free via new technology or for inexpensively, that has enormous benefit. The other thing that's not on the slide is things that 18 months from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, are going to become preeminent technologies. So the idea that you can set a business strategy around social media or the internet in general and just sort of leave it, that too is over. New things are going to emerge, and MySpace is a good example. If your company had been out ahead of the curve and had invested time and effort in having a presence on MySpace, you better have figured out a way fairly quickly to have adapted or added to that strategy to accommodate Facebook. Otherwise, one of your competitors would have. Another factor that is relevant, I think, and this is probably particularly relevant for folks in Generation Y, but by 2050, Spanish will be spoken by the majority of Americans over English. The demographics are shifting. As the world opens up, being multilingual is going to be important as well. And as I said, 78% of the articles on Wikipedia are not in English. There are great resources, but there are also going to be challenges for American business to figure out, you know, if you're talking to a global audience, what does that mean? So let's talk for a minute about how we talk about things. So 10,000 years ago, we're all sitting around the campfire, and we could have this discussion in person. We could say, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to be hunters or gatherers? Are we going to trade with the tribe downstream from us or go to war with them? And the outcome of whatever we decided was public. We all see if it worked or not. We could adapt our decisions in real time to that. We could choose new leaders. We could choose to, you know, go off on our own if we wanted to, if we didn't like what was happening. And that worked pretty well. You know, our tribes went from tribes to towns to cities to nations. And come the 20th century, now we have a very different kind of communication. We're all too far flung to sit down and have those individual conversations with our tribe. So we need information fed to us. It's editorial, it's centralized, content's determined. So we get things like all the news is fit to print, and we've learned to consume information in a very one-way fashion. Well, so eventually they started adding in a little more feedback. They let people call into the talk shows, publish a few letters to the editors. The companies get smart and start allowing for some customer testimonials, like the doctor who will say that your cigarettes improve your breathing. But it's a very much a controlled inclusion. And then social media bursts on the scene, and we're back where we started. Except that now, around the campfire, there's 6.6 billion of us. And people can talk about anything they want. They can say unpleasant things, or they can say things that support you. So if you want them to speak well of you, you need to give them a good reason. If you do give them a good reason, you will get them to engage with your company, your products, in unprecedented ways. You have an opportunity here to build trust where to replace some of the suspicion that people have rightfully gotten over advertising over the years. The opportunity here is to engage people is going to be vital to American business as we move into the 21st century. And here's why. Monster.com, the conference board of the New York Times, surveyed over 100,000 people and asked them what made them happy, what made them want to stay in their job or leave. And so they're happiest, surprise, when they're valued and when they have input, when they're recognized for their achievements. And what do they do when they're involved and engaged? They put in discretionary effort. They go the extra mile to recommend a colleague to come work for you. They go the extra mile for the client. They suggest new novel ideas for products or creative ways to solve problems. What if they're not engaged? Well, like they say, some people quit and leave, others quit and stay. I can tell you from having worked in many different sizes of organizations, from 3 people to 50,000, that's true in every organization, and you don't want it. Stephen Covey, who I think you're pretty familiar with for writing The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, was also doing some research for his book called The 8th Habit. And he went out and he surveyed another 32,000 people, and he asked them kind of a broader number of questions. You know, do you feel like your the goals of your company are clear to you. You get the support you need from your manager. How much of your time do you spend fulfilling your job function? How much do you spend in office politics or in engaging in things that it's the time wasting? And he came up with some very interesting data. You know, he found that only about a third of the people could actually say clearly what their company's goal were. And only about half of those really cared. He found out that only about 1 in 5 people clearly understood what their own job function was supposed to be within the organization. Because with most people, their jobs changed over time, and nobody bothered to write them up a new job description. And he found that 80% of those 32,000 people said that they spent either some or a lot of their time on office politics, on trying to get a budget versus some other department, on working on ways to get promoted, basically on things that hampered the company. And he thought, well, these are all very good data points, but they're kind of abstract. So he wanted to come up with an analogy for what does disengagement look like in a company. And he said, well, what if your company was a soccer team? Now, if you have a soccer team and only 4 of your 11 players know which goal is yours, and only 2 of them care, you're not going to win a lot of games. And if all but 2 of your players are in some way competing against your own team, the other team's going to end up doing pretty well. This is germane to U.S. business in the 21st century, because if we do not do a good job of engagement, someone else will somewhere else. It's no longer a matter of one ascendant U.S. company replacing one that didn't do it right. It's now potentially one Indian or Chinese company, Russian company, fill in the blank, supplanting you, because more and more work can be done from anywhere. So disengagement is, engagement and disengagement are, I think, perhaps the most important thing for businesses to pay attention to. What about the real return on investment of engagement? Now, these folks aren't just engaged. They've had a little bit too much of the company happy juice this morning. there's very real benefits. Share prices of companies with engaged employees, 16% against the industry average of 6. Operating margins almost 6% better versus companies that are disengaged. And then the costs. You have costs here in the billions of dollars from low productivity. Most significantly, you have the U.S. Department of Labor estimating that the U.S. economy loses $5 trillion a year in turnover, in retraining, in HR, in loss of intellectual capital. So we have an annual GDP of about $14 trillion, could be $19. But more significantly, 2 days ago, President Obama proposed a budget for all of 2010 for everything. Social Security, Medicare, Homeland Security, Department of Transportation, Education, everything. It was $3.8 trillion. Okay? So, I mean, the implications for us as a country that is confronting difficult economic times and potentially large future deficits are pretty enormous here. I do take that $5 trillion number with a bit of a grain of salt, but I have no doubt that it's very expensive, because any of you who have been involved in running a business and see those costs firsthand, having to retrain people, losing clients because you haven't experienced people working for them, they're very real costs. So I want to look real quickly at a couple things that we do at my company that we have tried to do via social media. These are not via, you know, Twitter and LinkedIn, but a couple things that we've done internally to try to increase engagement, and then show you kind of the effect that had for us. So again, looking at those 3 things that they want, people want input, and they want to know what's going on. So one of the things that we started about 4 years ago was we have twice a year town hall meetings. Just like this, myself and the other senior leaders of the company sit at a table up front, and people can come and ask us absolutely anything they want, and we'll answer it for them. They can also submit questions anonymously for 2 weeks beforehand, and we will read them verbatim, no matter how snarky they may be, and answer them. What that did was it told people it's okay to question management, to ask us, why are we doing this? Could we change something? And what it really did is it cut down a great deal on the behind-the-scenes chatter, on people filling in the blanks for themselves if they were unsure of a move the company made or of a guess.
But this posting is really intriguing, because one, that is, it starts the conversation between employees. Is this something that was visible to everybody beforehand?
The questions?
Yeah, the questions being on the submitted
questions. Not initially. The first couple years of the town hall, we just had the questions submitted, and then we would come and answer them and take additional questions. What I have up here is what we decided about a year ago is, you know, there's no reason to do this twice a year. We can do this all the time. So we started what we call the You Ask, We Answer online forum. People can submit anonymously or otherwise. And we have a 24-hour commitment to turn around and answer them. Once in a while, we can't do that if it requires research or something. But I don't know how well you can read some of those up there, but they're everything from, you know, can we get a healthier software adoption in the kitchen, to what about a different retirement plan option, what's the status of our profit sharing plan. And so we post these all online. And what it does is it really gives people a very deep understanding of the company. It's all archived, so I don't need to go in there and look at all the questions that everybody asked. And it's seen a huge decrease in the amount of HR costs you have, in the amount of people who are confused by something. And the other thing is, it's given us great insight. I mean, instead of having six people on board of directors, we've got to set direction. You can get 200 people to come in and give you their ideas for free. That's pretty amazing as a company, and all it takes is just asking them again.
Whose responsibility is it to provide an answer? The CEO of a lot of companies that talk about soft drinks in the kitchen that maybe they want to be,
sure.
They know about them.
So, yeah, so the question was, who has the responsibility for answering the questions? The CEO is not going to necessarily weigh in on the soft drinks in the kitchen, right? Basically, there are about a dozen people who automatically get each question that comes in email to them. And usually, it's fairly obvious who should take it. So our HR person will say, hey, I've got this one. Or our finance, our CFO will say, I can answer this one on the retirement plan. But it's just kind of a, you know, whoever has the bandwidth to answer it. And then, if it hasn't been answered within 24 questions, we have someone who's responsible for making sure that it's, that someone does, in fact, take it up.
This is another question.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm an older guy, so, but anonymity, how do you establish or convince your people that their questions are really anonymous in an age where you track anything that anybody else?
Well, and that's a good question. How do you convince people that people are really anonymous in an age where you can track anything? The long and the short of it is we haven't had to convince them of that. We've told them that. We've adhered to that. We've never gone back to anybody and said that the way the form is set up on our internet, it does not record who posts on that page. But yeah, I mean that could be a concern if you have an area where trust hasn't been established. Because we started with the town hall and said, hey, we're going to come up here and answer whatever you have to ask us, I think people were coming to it from more of a position of trust, so it made it easier for them to believe in that. So the other thing that we did, in addition to that, I should say, we also post quarterly financials for the company, and the CFO and I write a kind of one-page synopsis of helping to interpret this. Because we have a profit sharing plan, so we want people to understand how that's playing in. The other couple of things that we did was, you know, we want to recognize people and we want to let experts step up. So we started something called a kudos program, again, about 4 years ago. We asked our clients as well as fellow employees to call out exceptional performers. We get about 100 kudos submitted a quarter, and we pick the top three of those to post on our internet as well as in our newsletter, and those people actually get the award that goes along with that. So it's a very public forum to show who our achievers are. We also give out yearly company awards for a number of things, and all of those are determined by non-executive, non-director people, so it's people nominating each other for awards, and it's not like the president's award for this, it's who's been a great behind-the-scenes contributor type award. And then just about 4 months ago, we started encouraging employees to blog and basically said, you know, talk about whatever you want. If you want to talk about a great restaurant event on Saturday, that's great. If you want to share some technical knowledge, that's great. But just get out there and try it. And so, again, we have everything here from looking at last year's recycling numbers as part of our green program. We have a developer on here who's posting a cool new way he found to work with cascading style sheets. And we have some ideas posted on here about is there a better way that we could surface some expertise within the company. So, again, this is giving people a forum to demonstrate their knowledge. We call out people who are doing an exceptional job here, and you have basically free employees educating each other and demonstrating, getting to know each other better through this platform. At the bottom of this page, I have a quote from Mike Byam, who wrote a book called The Wild Workplace. It says that for every dollar you spend, you should get 3 to 5 back. So my question is that actually true? Here's what we've seen. Over the past 2 years, our company has had a 6% voluntary attrition rate. That means not someone who's left because their contract ended. They do left because they felt that there was somewhere else better to work, or they left for more money, whatever the case may be. That's versus 30% in our industry. So what that means is that compared to our competitors, we have about 1/5 the cost in a lot of key areas. More significantly, we have 5 times the retained intellectual capital and client project familiarity. We have people who've been with us for a long time, who know our business, who know our clients. That gives our clients tremendous peace of mind. They feel like there's continuity there. They hire us again and again to work for them. As Dean mentioned, you know, this led to a number of awards that we've won, including being nominated, one of 5 companies nominated by Microsoft globally for service excellence. Hope we get that. So for a company of 200 people, I think that's a pretty significant achievement. That has been our experience, by and large. That's the end of my formal presentation. I'm happy to take other questions, and I'm also happy to talk with any of you outside of this about ways that you can use social media, take further questions you might have. And I put a couple things on here that you may want to check out. There is a group in Seattle called Social Media Club Seattle that's free to join. They do a lot of great events where you get to go meet other people who are involved with social media efforts in their company. And there's also the Enterprise 2.0 conference, which covers not just social media, but kind of how workplaces are evolving to handle flexible work arrangements, global workforces, things like that. There's one that's in Boston in June, and one in San Francisco in, I believe, September. And then a couple of books that I've already recommended, The Socialnomics by Eric Wallman and Made to Stick, that I passed out to a couple of you.